Are you ready then?
Oh yeah.
Number 9.
Yep. Yeah.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, aliens and humans from across the galaxy, to the Life of Caesar podcast, the only podcast worth listening to, except there's a few others that are probably good. Yeah. My name is Cameron Riley. With me, as always, the Emperor of the Seven Known Kingdoms. No, hold on, that's Game of Thrones. I was thinking of the Ray Harris. I won't get on the sidetrack. Hey, Ray.
Hi there. Hey, how's it going?
I was thinking of our theme music today, and I was in my head. It was going dun 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 dun, dun, dun. And I was like, "No, that's not right. What's that?"
We might get sued.
Yeah, that's right. Do you watch Game of Thrones?
I've seen the first 3 seasons, right? I guess.
So you're not up to date. I shouldn't throw any spoilers.
Right, please don't bloop me. Please do not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, kids. Yeah. Well, before we get into the show. As is our tradition that we started like last week, episode, we're gonna do a shout out to the producers of episode number 9. And if you're new to the show and this is the first time you've listened, what are you doing? Go back to the beginning. You can't start at episode 9.
1, 2, 3, exactly.
Yeah. We're gonna give a shout out to the people that have written nice reviews. Well, any reviews, actually. That doesn't have to be nice.
No, I didn't. Mine wasn't nice. Oh, sorry.
Hey, by the way, and so if you write a review on iTunes or on Facebook or Twitter and you tell your friends or your enemies to listen to the show, we will give you a shout out as a producer and we will pick one, maybe sometimes two, lucky producers and they will get what, Ray?
They will get a handmade, not by Ray.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a hand something else there for a second. Like, wow, you're taking this seriously.
I'm not that dedicated. Anyway, a coffee mug, ceramic coffee mug with our logo on one side and a cute little nifty saying on the other side.
And I saw the photo that you posted on the Facebooks of this a couple of weeks ago, and it looks damn good. I want to buy one. Where can I buy one, Ray? That's right.
Well, what you can do is, and that's the beauty, you can buy one if you want. You can go to lifeofcaesarpodcast@gmail.com. Send me your name, your address, and let me know that you want to buy one. And I'd be happy to work up a cost and send something back to you. But if you put in a nice review and email me, I will also put you in that. And that way you might not have to put out the money in the first place.
You registered a Gmail address? You never told me about that.
Surprise. lifeofcaesarpodcast@gmail.com. So I've already gotten a couple of emails. One guy, John K. from Anoka, Minnesota, wants to buy one. And John, I've worked up the cost. Let's see here. Shipping, carry the 2, 10,000 denarii. And then you'll be all set, John.
And we know that a denarii is equivalent to, was it 8 asses? So that's a lot of ass. A lot of ass.
Sorry. Okay, John, let me refigure. I'll get back to
you, John.
You're
going to be getting a lot of ass, man, which I know is one of your life ambitions.
Caesar got a lot of that. We'll just let him keep on keeping on. Anyway, so John, I will get back to you, and thank you for writing the review. I really do appreciate it, and I think you're going to love the mug. It's very nice.
Well, I'm just going to rattle off quickly. We don't want to spend a lot of time on this. We want to get into the episode because we've got a lot to cover today. But some of the reviews, well, all of the reviews actually from since our last episode, which we recorded April 3rd, it's now April 23rd. Everyday Pod Geek, thank you. Tosfot, thank you. Hail the Emperor of Virginia and his tangent-loving cohort.
Wow.
I like that. Of course, a cohort was, an army unit in ancient Rome, consisting of about 480 men, but I don't have one of those.
No.
I look forward to each new episode, and it doesn't bonadea me to get sidetracked every once in a while. That's very good, Jla. Romy490, a fun podcast with in-depth history. 60s lover. Having listened to the History of Rome podcast, I was pleasantly surprised when I was invited to subscribe to this one. Did you send 60s Lover an invitation, a personal invitation? Was it a strippogram or something? Is it
something like that?
Is it everything I hoped it would be? Informative and entertaining.
Wow.
I like that.
Yes.
I think those were US. We've got some from the UK. Worker 34. I can't pronounce these names. Nice work. MBS 68. This is my favorite podcast.
Wow.
Wow.
Thank you. Thank you, MB 68. Yeah.
I'm honored. Nathan 2194. Nathan actually tweeted us as well to make sure that we got this. Oh, these are some Aussie ones. This podcast is fun to listen to and also is informative. I love these guys.
Well,
that's who does nice. Thank you. Thank you, Nathan. Yeah. D-Hours, and I saw, where's D? Oh, D-Hours is from New Zealand. Love the podcast. Lots of Roman podcasts out there. It's the tangents you go off on that make you different from all the rest. I want to hear about the Temple of Jupiter and its history. Thank you, D-Hours.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Some shout-outs on the Facebooks. Shlomo Bar Isle. Great podcast, like the chemistry, cigars destroyed in a glorious fire.
Ah, oh, yes. I wrote back to him. Thank you for that. Yes.
Don't say that. That's horrible.
Well, one end was destroyed by fire. The other end was in his mouth while he was puffing it.
Okay. Yes. Well, that's good. Yes. Chris Mirishikari Sutherland, loving this podcast. 10 out of 10. Wow. Ooh. Steve Murray, loving the podcast, guys. But the pronunciations are killing me. Okay, now Steve's a guy who told me that I'm pronouncing Pompey, Caesar's friend slash enemy,
right,
as Pompeii. Now, there's a good reason for that. I'm an Aussie, and we pronounce everything wrong. But I did realize, actually, before Steve sent the email, but I did realize recently that I've been pronouncing it wrong all my life because I'm an uneducated Australian. So, but just for the record, Pompeii should be pronounced Pompey. Yes. And I mentioned this to my wife last night. She says, first I've ever heard of it. So there you go.
Well, I'm going to try and say that from now on, Pompey.
Steve says he's an Aussie too, so it's not the accent. I'm just dumb. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for that. Philip Preet or Prate. I'm going to second guess my pronunciation of everything today.
Vowels.
He says he's visited the forum and have been to the spot where Caesar died. Doesn't say whether or not he was involved in it, but
right, probably was.
And Nathan, again, I think it's the same Nathan.
I like Nathan.
Yeah, Nathan, it's a good name. Had an equivalent entertainment value to the antics of a sweaty pirate cove. What? Mention? Oh. Yeah, okay. He wrote a comment that said something about sweaty pirates, and he said Apple didn't approve his comment. Oh, he's a Brisbane boy. Oh. Hey, good on you, Nathan.
Nathan, hey, when you get a chance, send me an email to lifeofcaesarpodcast@gmail.com. I want to send you a mug just for that.
Oh, Nathan gets a mug. Well, if you send me one to Brisbane, you can send two to Brisbane, boyo. I will cover the costs of my own coffee mug because I am that kind of guy. Right. But seriously, I think they're a good-looking coffee mug, man.
Yeah.
And don't forget, if you get a coffee mug, send us a photo. Ray Gibby. We haven't seen Ray's photo yet from last episode. He was our inaugural winner. Anyway, send us a photo. We can put on the website of you drinking hot beverage or cold of your choice, because these coffee mugs will handle cold, I believe, Ray.
Yes, they can handle it all.
This is American technology for you, ladies and gentlemen. That'll handle hot and cold, and they only cost 10,000 denarii each.
Quick, I want to say thank you to David B. from Coldwater, Michigan, for writing in and giving us a nice review on the U.S. iTunes. Thank you. And Teresa B. was on the Facebook Life of Caesar podcast. I don't think she really gets how this works. She just wrote in and said, can't wait to get mine. So I think she's a little confused. But Teresa B., you're certainly in the running for my random selection of a coffee mug winner.
Was she talking about a coffee mug?
Oh, God, I hope so.
So where did we end last time? The end of episode 8, if I recall correctly, Caesar got the hell out of Dodge and went to Spain. Why did he go to Spain?
Well, first he was selected to govern it as a propraetor. Also, there was the trial going on of Clodius with the whole Bonadea thing, and he just wanted to get the hell out of town. But he was actually excited about being a governor for the first time, and he was going to test his abilities, see what he can do as far as being in charge and being responsible. Plus, he needed to go and make some cash because he barely got out of Rome because his debtors did not want him to go. But Crassus backed him up, so now it's off to Spain to make some money and to serve the people of Rome.
Yeah, sure. There was that too. No, I'm serving. Yeah. It's not all about just, you know, raping and pillaging the Spaniards. So this was an important step, obviously, in his political career. He needs to establish some credibility. He needs to show that he can govern. But, of course, and it wasn't just Caesar that was trying to make money. This was a very common tactic for governors of the ancient Roman Republic, is they would make bank, and not just for themselves, but, you know, often for their friends, their soldiers. They would build support for themselves politically by, and obviously some of the money went back to Rome as well. Some of it.
Yeah. Enough.
Yeah.
But before we get into Caesar and too much detail in Spain, I think it's worth pointing out that a person who's about to loom very large in his life and the life of Rome is also sitting there on the wings, and that's Pompey Magnus, who has returned from the East. He returned in 62 BCE, and he was about to have his third triumph. He had finally defeated Mithridates. He had settled the East. He went around to all the different places, Cappadocia, Bithynia, all over the Asian province, and he literally set the East back up again on some sort of stability. And he literally would hear everybody's problems. You're good for Rome. You stay. You're bad for Rome. You're out. And he literally took care of the East. It took him years, took like an extra two years to set the East up. He finally comes back to Rome, and now he wants his third triumph. He wants land for his veterans, and he wants the Senate to approve his Eastern settlement in one big package. He just wants them to approve it as is. And he did do a really good job. He was pretty fair to Rome's advantage, but he did a really good job. And the Senate, being led by Bibulus and Cato, they're not going to let him have his way. So Pompey is very frustrated. There's no point in being the rock star of Rome if you can't do whatever you want. So there's Pompey. He celebrates his third triumph in late September of 61 BC, while Caesar's out in Spain. He's 45 years old, but the Senate won't do anything that he wants, so he's frustrated. And then on the other hand, there's Crassus, who's also frustrated, even though he's a very rich, powerful man. He needs the Senate to change the tax farming scheme that his friends and partners, they got the contract in Asia, and they literally bid too high. They can't collect enough money. They need the amount of money lowered by the Senate that they need to bring back. The Senate says no because they don't like him either. So both of these powerful, rich men have their problems, and Caesar is going to see this as an opportunity to bring them all together as a group and support him. Even though these two men hate each other, when he gets back from Spain, he's going to go after these two men and bring them all together.
Yeah, and let's remind people that you say they hate each other, but they were a few years earlier, I think around 70 BCE, they were co-consuls. So they had worked together, had a big falling out. But, I mean, you said here that, the Senate didn't like them. I think the Senate were concerned about the amount of power and influence that Pompey and Crassus both had, and they were trying after everything that's happened, let's, keep in mind, as we've said since the beginning of the series, you got to keep in mind the recent history of Rome, Sulla, et cetera, and, Marius before that, and Sulla, and all of the these guys that get too much success, too much power, all of the destabilization that had happened of the Republic. Plus, also, there's just, pure political competition, too. I mean, as we've said a number of times also, these guys don't like seeing anyone else, get too popular or too successful, because they want the power, they want the auctoritas. They want it for themselves. So there's a lot of healthy competition going on. They're going, Pompey, Crassus, maybe. No, I don't think so. You've had your day in the sun. You're not getting any more. We're not going to pass these laws even though, or we're not going to give you an easy out on the taxation thing. Even though, you know, it's reasonable, we're not going to do the reasonable thing because,
right,
we don't want you to have another win. We don't want you to be even more popular or more wealthy than you currently are. The triumph, the third triumph for Pompey too, is fascinating, right? Like, it just to put that in, to remind people about what a triumph is as well. Because you mentioned that Pompey was only 45, he was celebrating his third triumph.
Right.
Now, to get a triumph, you had to have been hailed by your troops as imperator, obviously the word that we get emperor from.
Mm-hmm.
In order for your troops to hail you as imperator, you had to have had an especially good victory out in the battlefields, usually one where there was, you know, very few Roman deaths, but a lot of enemy deaths or prisoners or loot or something like that. It was basically Gulf War One.
Right.
You know, you just go in, you clean up, Storm and Norman style. Mm-hmm. No one gets hurt on your end, but you kick ass on the other side.
Right.
So your troops would declare you as imperator. And then the Senate, I think, you'd have to apply to the Senate for a triumph, mm-hmm. and they would normally grant it to you. But it was very rare. This is the point. Very, very rare for this to happen. And Pompey, just to put Pompey into context, he's getting three.
Right.
Like, this is ridiculous. This is, I think, quite possibly unheard of in the history of the Republic at this time. So this guy is badass, man.
Right.
It's, you know, totally badass.
Right. I mean, most senators will go their entire life. They go up the cursus honorum. They become aedile, praetor, consul, censor, whatever, and never have a triumph. And here he is, 45, about to have his third. I mean, that's just breaking all the records.
And we've made a bit of fun at his expense before, like, you know, the whole slave war thing against Spartacus,
right,
cleaning up at the end and going, look what I did. You know, he had a few of those things, but obviously, I mean, he was a very, very successful general.
Yes. Did you want to talk about like some of the stuff on his triumph? What his, when you have a triumph, you have floats that celebrate your deeds.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about some of those? Because that was just staggering, the information.
Yeah. Well, you can talk about the floats, but I'll talk about the some of the stats, which I like, because I did some analysis of this last night. People may recall that when we talked about his first triumph back in episode, I don't know, 3 maybe, you know, he was riding in a chariot pulled by elephants, and he was, you know, doing some crazy
right.
shit. This time it wasn't so crazy, but there were placards talking about his successes, and one of them apparently declared that he had killed, captured, or defeated 12,183,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah. Taken or sunk 846 warships and accepted the surrender of 1,538 towns or fortified places. Now, I worked out, so 12.1 million people sounds like a lot. even today,
yeah.
It sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
But at the time, the estimated world population was about 200 million people. So 12 million was about 5%, over 5%, maybe 6% of the world population.
Right.
Now, the equivalent today would be about 300 million people, the population of the United States.
Right.
So this guy had basically,
yeah.
killed or defeated 5% of the world's population.
Right.
That's crazy.
Well, it was very, very dense population areas in the east that he went to. So, yeah, a lot of people knew the name Pompey. And so by the time he and Caesar are going to go at it, everybody in the east is just going to assume that Pompey is going to win because to them, he's like a god. I mean, he cannot be defeated.
And he had, you want to talk some more about his triumph? You know, he had like over 300 senior hostages, meaning like kings, queens,
right.
princesses, chieftains, generals walking ahead of him.
yeah, all
imagine,
decked out.
Imagine,
yeah.
Yeah, all decked out in their national robes. And he's like, yeah, bitches, look what I got. I mean,
yeah. But what was so amazing was he paid each one of his soldiers like 1,500 denarii, which was the equivalent of just over 10 years of regular pay for them. So they're loving this guy. They would do anything for him. He gives the state treasury something just over 20,000 talents of silver and gold. So as much as the senators can bitch about him, I mean, he takes care of all their financial needs, and just in one swoop, he just dumps a ton of gold and silver into the coffers of Rome. And now, you know, Rome is looking good.
And it's not just one-offs either. It's like the taxation base of Rome. He claimed that as a result of his campaigns, the annual taxation base of the Republic had more than doubled. It had gone from 50 million denarii to 135 million denarii. Nearly trebled, really, as a result of his campaign. So, you know.
Big deal, yeah.
The guys, I mean, who's a modern equivalent of Pompey? Can we think of anything close?
Well, define modern, I don't know.
I mean, Napoleon, you know, would have had a similar claim a couple hundred years ago. But, I mean, general, who's bringing money into the country. I mean, I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
And what's his thanks for all this? The Senate, controlled by a very small group of men, stymie his Eastern Settlement Bill. They won't give land to his veterans. And so Pompey is pissed. So he needs help. He needs help from someone else.
And that's... I was just going to make a pee joke there, but I won't. Because it's probably kids listening.
That's right.
Sorry, kids.
Don't smoke, kids.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, send them to us. That's right.
So now we can get to...
I don't know. Is there anything else you want to talk about his triumph?
No, I think we covered that pretty well. I was just going to say, okay, that's the stage that we've set. And now if you want to, we can go to Caesar in detail in Spain for his governorship.
Actually, well, there's a couple of things I want to say about Pompey before we move on.
Okay.
is that right?
Absolutely.
One of the things that he had done in one of his campaigns that I found was interesting is he went into Jerusalem, there was a civil war going on between the Judean royal family, and Pompey just decided to lay siege to Jerusalem. But one of the things that was interesting is when he entered Jerusalem, he and his commanders walked into the Great Temple.
Right.
Which was something that was, you know, forbidden.
That's right.
But, you know, he's not going to care. But interestingly, he didn't loot it. He left all of the treasures there.
Right.
Instead of, you know, usual practice would have been to send him back to Rome. But this was, you know, another way of him making a name for himself, because this was a new story for him to tell. I don't really understand, like, why the Great Temple, you know, why the Great Temple of Jerusalem deserved, from Pompey's perspective, that mark of respect.
Right.
Got any thoughts on that?
The only thing I've read, and you never know which true, is that he was thinking long term and it's like, yeah, I could take all this. Lord knows, no pun intended, I've got enough gold and silver now. But I think he was thinking long term that if he had taken all of that, he would have just really made it life hard for the next Roman governor. I mean, he was already taking gold and he'd already entered the temple in the first place, which he was not supposed to do. So the best I can give you is I think he was thinking long term and he didn't want to rub them the wrong way too much.
Don't piss off the Jew.
Exactly.
But 100 years later, they destroy the temple. So.
Right, yes. But
I hope they looted it before they destroyed it.
Right.
But the thing that marked pretty much the end of his campaigning was the death of Mithridates in 63.
Yes.
No, see, this is the thing. And I was thinking about, like, we, you know, because we're sort of telling the story from the Roman perspective, we see Mithridates as the bad guy.
Right,
Mithridates was a fascinating guy. I mean, I spent some time last night really, you know, reading up a lot. And we should do an entire, like, series on Mithridates, or at least a show on Mithridates.
He deserves it. He more than deserves it.
To remind people who Mithridates was, he was the king of Pontus and Armenia Minor in northern Anatolia, which is now Turkey. He was the king from about 120 to 63. Mm. So he ruled a long time.
Right.
At this stage, he was defeated by Pompey. You know, he'd been fighting the Romans for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And he allegedly tried to attempt suicide by poison, but didn't die because he had developed an immunity to poison. Now, here's this is amazing. So this is according to, I got some stuff here, according to Appian's Roman History. He said, he wrote, Mithridates then took out some poison that he always carried next to his sword and mixed it. There, two of his daughters, who were still girls growing up together, named Mithridates and Nysa, who had been betrothed to the kings of Egypt and of Cyprus, asked him to let them have some of the poison first and insisted strenuously and prevented him from drinking it until they had taken some and swallowed it. It's, you know, right. Family loyalty.
There you go.
The drug took effect on them at once, so they died. But upon Mithridates, although he walked around rapidly to hasten its action, it had no effect because he had accustomed himself to other drugs by continually trying them as a means of protection against poisoners. These are still called the Mithridatic drugs, is according to Appian.
Ah.
So he saw one of his bodyguards, Bitulus there, who was a Gaul, and he said to him, I have profited much from your right arm against my enemies. I shall profit from it, most of all, if you will kill me and save from the danger of being led in a Roman triumph, one who has been an autocrat so many years and the ruler of so great a kingdom, but who is now unable to die by poison because, like a fool, he has fortified himself against the poison of others. Although I have kept watch and ward against all the poisons that one takes with his food, I have not provided against that domestic poison, always the most dangerous to kings, the treachery of army, children, and friends. Bitulus thus appealed to, rendered the king the service that he desired. So he killed him with his sword.
Wow.
But according to Wikipedia, I was fascinated by this. In his youth, after the assassination of his father, Mithridates V, in 120 BC, Mithridates is said to have lived in the wilderness for 7 years, inuring himself to hardship. He's like Bruce Wayne, man. Right. Like in the first Christopher Nolan Batman movie, he's like, right, I'm gonna get myself put in the harshest of jails in Alaska, Russia. I'm gonna get punched and beaten up. I'm gonna toughen myself up, man. He's a ninja. This guy was he was Batman. While there in the wilderness and after his accession, he cultivated an immunity to poisons by regularly ingesting sublethal doses. He invented a complex universal antidote against poisoning. Several versions are described in the literature. Aulus Cornelius Celsus gives one in his De Medicina and names it Antidotum Mithridaticum.
Wow.
Pliny the Elder said that it comprised 54 ingredients to be placed in a flask and matured for at least 2 months. And also, Pliny the Elder, again, also says that Mithridates was a polyglot. He had lots of glots.
Right.
Could never have enough glots.
That's right.
Mithridates.
Ooh.
Loved the glots. Just loved the glots. He's nuts for the glots. He could speak the languages of all 22 nations he governed.
Wow. Wow.
Dude, he was immune to poison, could speak 22 languages, ruled for nearly 60 years.
He deserves his own podcast.
And when, you know, he knew he was finally defeated, rather than get made, you know, to a prisoner and have to lead a trial for Pompey. He tried to poison himself. When that failed, he got his soldier to kill him. That's nearly as good as Cato's death, which I don't want to jump the gun. But, oh, man, I was reading about Cato's suicide.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, what a story. Anyway, that's Mithridates. So, respect.
Absolutely.
Is what I'm saying for Mithridates, man.
Rome is breathing a sigh of relief that he is now gone. And whether he deserves it or not, Pompey gets all the credit. Which he doesn't deserve, but he gets all the credit.
He deserves a lot of the
credit. He does, but Catullus, I think it was Catullus, wasn't he?
Lucullus.
Lucullus, sorry. He wore him down for years, but Mithridates will be long remembered in Rome.
So, where are we going? Back to Spain?
Yeah, let's go back to Spain.
So I think we mentioned at the end of the last episode, when Caesar gets to Spain, one of the first things he does, which is kind of ironic considering his debt situation, is he decrees that a debtor has to pay 2/3 of his income to his creditors until the debts have been made up.
Right.
Well, yeah, did you think that? I think that was maybe just a guilt thing.
Well, yeah, but at the time it was seen as forward thinking because normally they would just take everything until your debts. He's like, no, these people have to live. They have families. You get 2/3. The debtor gets 2/3. He gets 1/3 so he can go on living. It was very progressive at the time.
Right. So it was actually to the benefit of the debtor.
Yes.
Well, that's good on Caesar. He obviously felt for the debtors.
Yeah.
And one of the first things he did was to fight off the Lusitanians. He raised 10 new cohorts of troops.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned earlier, a cohort was an ancient Roman military unit comprised of 6 centuries, was 1/10 of a legion. A cohort had about 480 men.
Right.
And I was just thinking, I mean, it's not hard. I mean, we all know Caesar was this great, successful general, but really not hard to be successful general when you can just raise... You know,
it helps.
5,000 new soldiers at the drop of a hat, you know.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
But what really gets me is what even though this kind of gets glossed over in his life, I mean, he's had military experience in the past. We talked about the pirates and what he did in Asia, but here he is totally in charge and all the responsibility is his. And he's not just a military man. He's also the governor. He's also got to take care of non-martial events as well. But he does a very good job. And they say that as a little boy, he would listen to Marius talk about the science and the art of waging war. Caesar never got caught when he was in Spain. He never got caught in a trap. He always fought on land and time of his choosing. He always decided when there would be battle, which was best for him. He was just a very good, solid, all-around general. And some of that was probably natural. Some of that he probably got from Marius and experience. But he, even though he's tested for the first time in a lot of ways, he comes through it with flying colors.
And you know, he continues the Roman tradition of sort of being generous
yes.
to the people that he defeated. You know, the Roman idea was when you defeat your enemy, you don't crush their bones into powder. You try and turn them into useful, productive, tax-paying members of the Republic.
Exactly.
Well, of the province, I guess, and of the Republic so much, but... And so, you know, he was known as being fairly generous and willing to accept the surrender of his enemies. He also apparently has, they said he suppressed the practice of human sacrifice in some of the local cults there. Human sacrifice, obviously being, it had even been practiced in Rome.
Right.
Up until recently, too, I think when the Germans were attacking, you know, just before Caesar's birth, we talked about the Cimbri and the Teutones. There was still some human sacrifice happening to the gods to try and prevent that, but it had, by this stage it had been, you know, outlawed in Rome.
Yeah, I mean the Romans are like, we pretty much don't care what you do. You behave yourself, you pay your taxes, you want to worship your own god or gods, that's fine. But they drew the line more or less at human sacrificing, and he, to the best of his ability, put it out where he came across it in his province in further Spain.
Mm. And they think he made some... I mean, his time in Spain isn't very well documented, but
right.
the general consensus is that he probably made some money while he was there, but nowhere near enough
right.
to take care of his debts back home.
Yeah, but he made some cash to literally... Again, he's playing for time. His entire life... The second he steps out of his door, he puts on the show when the eyes of the public are on him. His entire life is all about being consul. So he's going to make some money in Spain, not nearly enough, because if he goes too far, he knows he'll be brought up on charges. And he's got his eyes on the prize. He's going to do what he has to do, and nothing's going to get in the way of that.
And of course, as we've mentioned before, but it's worth repeating, you couldn't be consul until you were 40. And he's just coming up on 40.
Right.
So it, there's a plan here. There's a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to get back to Rome and apply to be consul or try to get elected consul on just after his 40th birthday. So he goes back, but there's this great story about on the way back to – it's probably not true, but it's probably a myth, but it's a great story about he and his party passing through this small alpine village – and, you know, it's fairly dirty,
mm-hmm.
but they can see, you know, some of the men of this village, even though they have nothing, squabbling over power. You know, who's the mayor of the tiny one-horse town?
Right.
And Caesar supposedly says that he would rather be the head man in a place like that than the second man in Rome.
Wow, yeah. And you never know what's true.
I call bullshit on that.
Yeah, you never know. But not only that, but I've read different times in my sources that he was, and who knows if this is true or not, but he was determined not only to be the first man in Rome, like Marius was, like Pompey is right now. He wants to be the greatest Roman that ever lived. He wants to be the first name that you think of when you think about the Roman Republic or the Roman Empire or whatever. But we don't know if that's true or not, but supposedly he was just projecting himself onto a whole other plane than what all these other, what his contemporaries were. And that little story there is just one more, whether it's true or not, we don't know, is indicative of that philosophy that people think of. There's one more thing we need to mention before he gets back to Rome. During his many little battles in Spain, he is hailed imperator on the field by his troops, which means right. when he gets back to Rome, he gets to petition for his own triumph, his which besides being consul, you think would be the greatest thing that ever happened to him.
Yeah, and you know, as we said before, very rare, you know, rarely happens at all. And for most generals, you're lucky to get it once.
Right.
So this is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But. So he gets back. Now, I was again criticized by one of our way too intelligent listeners who listen too closely in an earlier episode, talking about the difference between the Rubicon and the Pomerium.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for listeners who are dumb like me, I want to try and clarify this. So the rule was when you were coming back from being on campaign or being a governor and you had troops and the whole deal, you weren't allowed to cross the Pomerium, which was the sacred boundary of the city of Rome. It wasn't actually a wall, apparently,
right.
even though Merum in Latin meant wall. It was just a boundary. It was a line that everybody knew that you didn't cross over. Apparently, according to tradition, it was the original line plowed by Romulus around the walls of the original city.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole bunch of rules. You know, you were forbidden to bury the dead inside the Pomerium. Weapons were banned inside
right.
the Pomerium. But so it was this legally and religiously defined area. Now, the Rubicon, and we talked about this in the first episode, Caesar crossing the Rubicon, etc., was the boundary between the province of Cisalpine Gaul and Italy proper.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not the same thing.
Right.
Just clarifying that for people like me who go, well, he wasn't supposed to cross this, he wasn't supposed to cross that. Are they connected? No. Only, well, we'll talk about why he shouldn't have crossed the Rubicon in a later episode, but
right.
the Rubicon and the Pomerium, different things. Right.
And to add one more thing to that, in case anybody else wants to write in, when they had their triumphs, these soldiers had the wooden staves, the wooden swords. They weren't allowed to bring their swords, and even though they're soldiers, they had to leave those outside. So no weapons, nothing, martial is supposed to happen within the Pomerium, which is why when Gaius Marius did it, it was so heinous because it was unthinkable. You just do not do it.
And in fact, legally speaking, once they crossed the Pomerium, the soldiers were now citizens. They weren't soldiers.
Right.
So they they lost the rights that they had as soldiers when they were outside of, the actual Rome city itself. They couldn't kill people. They could beat them up but not kill
right.
them.
Right. And they could be sued. They could be sued because they were private citizens now.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's right. So Caesar comes, he heads back, and the deal is because the only time when soldiers, when you can go into Rome with your soldiers is if you're going to celebrate a triumph.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not allowed to, Caesar's not allowed to cross the Pomerium until the day of the triumph.
Right.
So he's waiting for this, he's hanging out I mean, and the Pomerium, so there was, like, there was, you know, it wasn't like they were in the wilderness here. There
right.
was the large part of, like, the suburbs of Rome, really, that were beyond the Pomerium. But he's hanging out. He's waiting for, you know, the call for the Senate to give him the nod. Yes, he can have your triumph. But
he doesn't get it.
The problem is that if he wants to be nominated for consul, he needs to do that in person.
Right.
And that's going to happen. Like, the cutoff line for the nominations is before his triumph. So he can't have both. He can either wait and get his triumph, once-in-a-lifetime mm-hmm. deal, probably.
Right.
Or he can go, screw the triumph, I'm going to go nominate for consul, with no guarantees that he's going to win, because he's up against, you know, some fairly, well-established people, and there's a lot of people supporting different guys and whatever. So what does he decide? What do you do in a situation? What's the bird in the hand is worth two in the bush? Does he take the triumph, or does he, no, okay, screw the triumph?
Yeah,
I'm going for the prize, as you said before. Well, what does he do, Raymond?
Well, what really makes it interesting is that Cato and Bibulus and the Boni, the good man, really thought they had him. He can't cross because he hasn't had his triumph, but he has to cross in order to declare his candidacy. And no one, and I mean no one, gives up a triumph because it's so rare. And every time the Senate wanted to talk about giving him a date for his triumph, Cato would filibuster until the sun went down, and once the sun goes down, you can't hold business anymore. So they finally thought they had him. He was going to have to wait a whole other year because he's not going to give up his triumph. And during that year, as a privatus, as a private citizen, his debtors could go after him. He could be hauled up in court for what he did or did not do in Spain. So they really think they've got him there. And you have to think about it from Caesar's point of view. And before too long, he goes, you know what? There's no way I could have a good triumph now. My men are still in Spain. The booty that I've won is still in Spain. It couldn't be organized. It couldn't be flashy. It couldn't be showy. And these are things that I'm known for. It couldn't be a Caesar-level triumph. It's just there's not enough time. So screw it.
Although the Republic actually paid for the triumph,
you know how, I mean, with everything that he did as an aedile, he was going to make it a triumph to remember, and he would have to outdo what Pompey just went through on his third. So he crosses the Pomerium, and he stands for consul. And even then, they try to fight him. The Boni tried not to let him do it, but he says, no, I've turned in all my books for being governor. I turned them into the Vestal Virgins the day before. Everything is in order. You cannot deny me this. And they say, all right. And now he is officially going to be a candidate for the consulship of 59 BCE. So he sacrifices this once-in-a-lifetime thing that for him is a greater prize, to be consul in his year.
Well, I think, and as you mentioned before, it's not just the prize. It's he can't be prosecuted
right.
for any misbehavior as governor of
further Spain, yeah.
Hispania, yeah. If he is consul,
right?
It's basically, I mean, this is
protects him.
Yeah, I was going to make an American reference to when LBJ had Kennedy assassinated, but I won't go there because I'll upset the Americans.
There you go.
He knows that this is his best chance of not only progressing his career, obviously, and getting the highest office in the land, but escaping punishment
right.
is to be consul. But I also want to point out here, you talked about Cato filibustering in the Senate. So Cato pretty much invented filibustering, as far as we know.
That's right.
Historically speaking. So the deal with this was, there was a law that the Senate had to conclude all business by dusk.
Mm-hmm.
And so Cato developed this, and he practiced it before against Pompey with his land agrarian law. And he was doing it again. It's like he would just get up and just talk for hours and hours and hours until it was dusk and the Senate needed to close up business. And, you know, people, particularly in the US, doesn't happen in countries like Australia. We don't have this. We'll just keep going. But, you know, in countries like the US, filibustering has become a popular tactic in the last 10 years in particular, I think,
right.
to stall the passing of legislation. But, you know, Cato invented this technique. Wily Stoic Fox, alcoholic that he was. I got in there. I knew you'd say that. You like pointing out that he was a drunk.
I do. I think it's and there's one.
He wasn't a drunk. He just liked to drink.
Okay, then I'm wrong. I apologize. There was one thing I wanted to get your a take on, Cameron, and this is so cynical. And I mean, I'm a pretty healthy cynic, but I think you've got me beaten way. Anyway, so what Caesar does, and you almost feel sorry for the other guy, but Caesar teams up with a man, and I cannot pronounce his name. I apologize. It's Lucius. Lucius, L, and the last name is Lucceius, who is
Lucceius.
There we go. Let's go with that. He is fabulously wealthy. He's running for consul. He has zero chance of winning. He just doesn't have the name recognition. So Caesar goes up to him and he goes, "Hey, buddy, we should run together. Why don't you spend your money?"
Hey, buddy.
He just grabs his toga, puts his arm around it, but hey, Ave, and he just he says, "Hey, let's run together. We'll run as a team. You spend money on us, and we'll use my popularity. We'll go in as a team. We'll work together. Rome will benefit from it. It will be awesome." And this guy goes, "Yeah." He spends all this money on the election. And I don't want to jump ahead, but basically, there's only two curule chairs in the Senate, and this Lucius is not going to be in either one of them.
Yeah,
that's just mean. I just thought that was, I mean, you admire it, but Caesar went, hey, money bags, let's get together on this.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, we don't really know if Caesar approached Lucceius or it was the other way around. Lucceius. Now, of course, he was one of the other candidates was Bibulus, and we remember Bibulus back from the days when they were praetors together, aedles. Yep. That's right. He was the guy that Caesar always overshadowed when they were aedles.
Literally.
And he is Cato's brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And so this is another reason why Cato's getting in the way, because, you know, Bibulus' family and, you know, Cato wants the family to succeed. As we've talked about in previous episodes, Cato promised to prosecute anyone suspected of electoral bribery, unless it's Bibulus. If it's Bibulus, that's all right.
It's my family. Yeah.
It's okay.
What are you going to do?
Cato,
what are you going to do?
Cato, this paragon of morals and virtues and ethics, but would look the other way for family.
Oh.
Yeah. By the way, Cato was only 35 at this stage, I wanted to point out. I always had, in my mind, Cato's always looks like he's 80.
Right.
But he was 35. Like, you know,
He had made a name for himself. Even though he hadn't been anything higher than a tribune, he was seen as one of the most powerful people in the Senate. And he was an ultra-conservative in some ways, or however you want to view that. And he was going to stop Caesar in any way he possibly could. And Bibulus was right there with him.
And we have to remember also, when we're talking about the relationship between Cato and Caesar, is that Cato's half-sister was Servilia.
Right. Caesar's
the love.
The love.
Yeah, love of Caesar's life. He's been having an affair with her since they were teenagers, probably. Like for 20 years, he's been doing Servilia on the side.
And there's one more thing we have to mention before the election. Before the election, the Senate, with Cato and Bibulus steering the way, they announce, and this is very just unheard of, and just in case Caesar wins, the consuls, once their year is up, instead of getting a nice, fat, rich province to go out and to rape and make a ton of money, which was the reason to be a governor, they were relegated to govern. Now, I don't even know if the word governing is proper, but basically they were going to be land surveyors for the hinterland inside of Italy with absolutely no chance to make any money. So is this going to hurt Bibulus? Yes, but this is going to hurt Caesar if he wins a lot more, because he needs to make money so he can start to pay back some of his debts.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I'd like to be the governor of rural Italy. It sounds nice to me, man. I mean,
yeah, but he needs
every day cigars and grappa, man.
Yeah, but
not Italian cigars though.
But he needs to take a bunch of bribes. He needs to sell favors. He needs to make a ton of cash so he can come back and pay off all his debts. But it doesn't look like that's going to happen.
So the election. Now, the election of consuls were elected by the Comitia Centuriata.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody's going to tell me I pronounced that wrong. It's probably Steve.
Steve. And it's at the end of July, the election.
And now, the Comitia Centuriata is the Century Assembly. It was one of the three voting assemblies in the Roman Constitution. What were the others, Ray? Off the top of your head.
Is that the People's Assembly?
Oh, God.
No. I'm drawing a blank right now.
The other assemblies were the Assembly of the Curia.
Oh.
Which at this stage of the Republic didn't really have much to do. It was sort of just ratified different things.
Right.
The Assembly of the Tribes. That was the Democratic Assembly of the Roman Citizens. Not to be confused, though, with the Plebeian Council.
Mm-hmm.
But the Assembly of the Tribes was the Democratic Assembly of Roman Citizens. It was interesting. It was originally broken up. There were 35 tribes of Rome, and they had nothing to do with bloodlines or ethnicity. They were really originally just where you live. They were like, what do we call them today? Like your voting zone.
What do we? Good gracious!
constituency. like a constituency, an area.
Almost counties or something. I don't know what you call.
Yeah, you would call them counties. Yeah. You know, but. But then you sort of inherited the tribe of your father. Mm-hmm. So over time, the geographical distinction lost. So you had the Assembly of the Tribe that would elect the quaestors, the curule aediles, and the military tribunes. And they also had the power to try judicial cases. Then you had, the Assembly of the Curia. That was made up of patricians from the early days of Rome. But then you had the Assembly of the Centuries. Now, this was made up of the Democratic Assembly of the Roman Soldiers.
Right.
And it was organized according to how much money you had, because, again, as we've pointed out in the past, but it's worth reminding people, being a soldier, you had to supply your own weapons and your own armor and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you had to be sort of relatively wealthy to be a soldier, at least. You know, most of the soldiers were coming from the ranks of the wealthy. And also, you know, you got to loot when you were out on campaign as well. So it was a way of earning wealth. So this was who elected the consuls. You had this century assembly, or the Comitia Centuriata, the army assembly.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting voted in by the army. That's a good model. That's a good system. And this had actually been around since before the Republic. This was founded by King Servius Tullius about a century before the founding of the Republic in 509. What else do I need to tell you about that? There were 193 centuries in each assembly, and that was broken down by how much property they owned. So you had different grades of centuries, and you had an officer class, you had an enlisted class, and then you had unnamed soldiers, and the highest classes got to vote first. And apologies to our British listeners there. I'm not insinuating that.
Sorry.
No one can speak good English. Yeah. And then when the majority of the vote for that particular
century
class, was in, it was decided that was the vote.
Mm-hmm.
Because it went in from wealthiest to least wealthy, a lot of the lower classes' votes didn't really matter. But that was kind of an overview of how the century assembly
obviously
worked.
The first two classes are going to matter a whole lot.
Yeah. So goes to the vote and Caesar wins.
Yay! Woo!
Let's just cut to the chase here. Yeah, so Caesar ends up as consul.
Senior consul.
And who comes second?
Bibulus.
So
Calpurnius.
His old buddy.
That's right. Should we mention that the guy who put up all the money with Caesar came in third?
Yes, okay. It gets nothing.
It gets nothing. So it's going to be Caesar and Bibulus, two men who don't like each other. They're going to be the consuls for 59 BCE.
Although when we say it gets nothing, I mean, yeah, you would have to. I mean, Caesar was known as being a reasonable guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would imagine that this was considered to be, you know, there were favors that would come back for this.
Oh, sure.
This was a loan. Yeah. Maybe he had financed the campaign. I don't really know what happened to Lucius later on, but I imagine Caesar would have looked after him to the best of his ability.
Right. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say also, just around about this time, Pompey divorces his wife with the unfortunate name of Musia, or Musia, I think.
Musia, yeah.
When he we talked about it, came back for his triumph, the first thing he did was divorce his missus. Now, she had been having an affair with Caesar, mm-hmm, allegedly.
Yeah.
How he had time to fit her in, I don't know, but he wasn't the only one.
Right.
Let's remember, Pompey. Who's anus?
No. She was having an affair also with Titus Labienus and Caesar some other people.
Right.
Yeah, sorry.
Let's remember, Pompey had been away on campaign forever.
Yes.
Right. So it's his fault. She needed to get some.
Right.
Now, interestingly, I was reading a little bit about this woman and trying to get, you know, perspective of what happened to her after she was divorced. So her first husband was Gaius Marius the Younger,
mm-hmm,
who was killed by our friend Sulla.
Right.
He had to pull a Sulla.
That's right.
And so then Sulla married her off to Pompey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after she was divorced from Pompey, she remarried again to Marcus Aemilius Scaurus, a stepson of Sulla.
Wow.
And lived to a ripe old age. Apparently, Augustus treated her with great respect. So,
good for her.
You know,
yeah.
She bounced back. Which I like to see. But she was also related to a couple of other characters. Metellus Nepos,
mm-hmm,
and Metellus Sella, who were both quite active at this stage in the Senate.
Right.
You know, we probably won't go into them in great detail, but she was very well connected,
yes,
obviously, being, you know, I don't know.
And she gets
married to Pompey and related to, well, not Marius, I guess. Yeah.
So Pompey is not helping himself with the Boni and some other people in the Senate by divorcing her, but she was sleeping around. And we should also know that Caesar also had an affair with Crassus's wife, but that didn't stop them from being good business and political buddies.
And Pompey needs a new wife, so he goes to Cato.
Oh, yeah.
And says, look, I need a wife. My son needs a wife. Servilia, your half-sister, mother of Brutus,
mm-hmm,
lover of Caesar, has two daughters. I want to marry one. My son's going to marry the other one.
Yeah, perfect.
Cato said, Pompey, you're one of the wealthiest, most successful, powerful men in the land.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, spits on him.
No.
Yeah. Straight up.
Again, Cato building a reputation for himself as being a dick. No, being prepared to say no to power.
Right.
When, you know, it would have had the obvious advantages.
Absolutely.
To say yes to Pompey.
Absolutely.
At this stage, but Cato again just says, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, yeah. So there is Pompey alone. He's frustrated. His eastern settlement hasn't been decided on. The Senate's pissing him off. He doesn't know what to do. He can't get land for his veterans. There's Crassus, who can't get the tax farming guys the answers that they need. So they're both very frustrated. And so now Caesar sees an opportunity because he has things he wants to do. Caesar doesn't want to be consul just for the sake of being consul. He has plans, and he certainly has plans after he's consul. And there's no way he can take on the Senate alone. So he pictures in his mind these three men getting together, but he's got to find a way to bring them all three together, to get over their egos and over their not liking each other. And he's going to have to do this.
But before we get to that.
Yes, sorry.
I do want to talk about the year before. 60. So we mentioned Metellus Celer before. Metellus Celer was going to win the consulship, it looked like. And Pompey didn't like Metellus Celer. Mostly because his name was really hard to say. 10 times fast, Metellus Celer, Metellus Celer, Metellus Celer, Metellus Celer. Actually, it's not that hard. So this is a great story. And like a lot of scholars think that 60 was the year when the Republic hit the point of no return. And I wanted to talk about this because, as we've said from the get-go, in order to understand Caesar, you need to understand the Roman Republic.
Mm-hmm.
In like this, you know, from 100 BCE to, you know, the Caesar's time, it was a bit of a mess. And so Pompey indulges in massive bribery to put somebody up who can run against Metellus Celer in 60.
Right.
Being the year before 59, because it's going backwards, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He put up Lucius Flavius. Now, there was, and you know, they... were proposing the land bill. Celer led the opposition against it. And there was this this massive argument. So it was so bad, this argument, that Flavius ordered Metellus Celer led off to prison.
Hell yeah.
Celer was a consul, right? Now,
yeah.
Consul is like, all right, I'll go to prison. He gets to prison. And he convenes a meeting of the Senate in the prison.
That's right.
Because the Senate needs to meet where the consul is. So, but before they can get to the prison to hold a Senate meeting, Flavius puts his tribune's bench, his desk,
right,
in front of the entrance to the prison. And no one's allowed to touch a tribune or a tribune's desk,
that's right,
apparently. So
sacrosanct.
They can't get into the prison. He's like, aha! Aha! Metellus. He goes, all right, that's good. I'll go you one better. He orders his guys to knock a hole in the prison's wall to admit the senators so they can have a meeting.
So they,
not to escape.
They break in.
Not to escape. Yeah, they break in. They break into the prison.
So they can run the government.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, so this is the kind of, you know.
Antics.
Yeah. The kind of absolute ridiculousness, the farce,
mm-hmm,
that was the Roman Republic at the time. Ooh. And so Pompey, you know, this time realized that this is a joke and said to Flavius, who was his puppet man, all right, release him,
yeah,
you know, forget it. Let's just, you know, the bill's not going to go through. So, I mean, this is what is happening the year prior to Caesar,
mm-hmm,
becoming consul.
Right.
Well, that was me passing the ball to you there,
oh,
buddy.
I'm sorry. No, I thought that was a good ending. Just basically, Pompey respects Caesar. He knows he's certainly a lot more intelligent than the other guys he's tried to hire. So Pompey is going to be halfway inclined to go along with Caesar. But Caesar's great fear is, well, once I get him his land bill and I get his eastern settlement taken care of, why would he be loyal to me to after that? So Caesar's got to think of Pompey long term. So he's going to have to come up with something to really tie this man to him. And we can talk about that next time.
Dun, 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 dun. Oh, wrong theme music.